From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of a pre-recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Jay Richards, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and co-author of The Price of Panic: How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Professor Richards in their conversation.
Now, these vaccines, there's one by Moderna now and one by Pfizer that are kind of the first across the finish line. Of course, they haven't gone through the normal FDA testing. We've never developed a vaccine for a coronavirus in history that's passed the FDA. And so there's just so many unknowns that I think, you know, I'm super hopeful. I mean, I hope these really do have a 90 or 95% effectiveness rate. I really hope that they're low cost to taking it. That would be terrific. But at the moment, we're getting this information from the press releases of the corporations who've developed them. And so I'm just sort of suspending judgment at the moment. But the reality is, because they've really not gone through the normal testing protocols, I don't think it would be rational. If you have a 10-year-old child who's healthy, honestly, if I had a 10-year-old child, I absolutely would not have my child get that vaccine, because the risk of the COVID-19 is so low and the risk of the vaccine is really kind of an unknown. On the other hand, if you're 70 and you have comorbidities and all of your friends have gotten it and seem fine, then maybe your risk calculation is different. But this idea that everyone should have to get the vaccine, no matter what their personal risk, that just doesn't make any sense to me.
I was thinking about sort of what's going on in the culture. You have governors shutting down churches to some degree, or curtailing what's going on in churches, and yet leaving strip clubs open. And at first blush, that seems completely irrational, but could it be that there's some rationality behind it? Because they're thinking, well, in church you sing, and that's a way of spreading the virus, but in strip clubs, you sit there silently and watch.
Honestly, my sense is that governors are just kind of shooting from the hip. I mean, in some ways, that's the most benign interpretation, is that they're thinking that way. In some cases, it seems almost so targeted toward churches. So here in the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C., I can tell you, Costco, they're limiting the numbers of people. It's always packed with people, and you can still buy as much liquor as you want in the Costco in D.C. where they sell liquor. But the National Basilica of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., right by Catholic University campus where I teach, okay, it can seat, Hank, 6,000 people. This is one of the largest buildings in the world. It's enormous. And District of Columbia allows 50 people to go in there at one time, which is laughable. And it's very hard for me to think of a rational reason for that. It looks very much to me like essentially politicians are just sort of deciding, oh, that's not important. People don't need to go to church. But of course, they need to get liquor at Costco. So, I mean, it's essentially reflecting their particular priorities, which tend to be overwhelmingly left-wing and secular, unfortunately.
We're involved in this multi-trillion dollar social experiment. And it's so interesting to me because you sort of have a whipsaw. You hear someone saying one thing one month and then something completely different the next month. So I'm thinking, for example, the Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, who wrote back at the beginning of the coronavirus, seriously, people, stop buying masks. They're not effective in preventing general public from catching coronavirus. So he is telling us not to wear masks. Don't buy them. Yes. Don't wear them. And now we're told that if we walk into a store without a mask, if we walk into a church without a mask, we're putting the populace in danger.
I mean, it's the craziest thing. And all of us remember that. But it's amazing how few people actually still realize the cognitive dissonance. I think people imagine that there have been these major new studies that somehow prove that masks work, when nothing's changed on this. In fact, all the data is basically the same as it's always been. At best, I would say it's ambiguous. But what was really weird about the messaging at the very beginning is they would say, people don't buy masks and don't wear them. They don't work. And if you buy them, you'll prevent healthcare workers from having them, which is really bizarre because that implies they work, right? I mean, now what they could have said is, unless these masks are worn properly and constantly changed and you've been trained in it, they're going to not make any difference. And so let the people that, since there's a shortage of them, let the people that are really at risk and know how to wear them, leave them for them. That would have been treating us like adults. So they essentially would not treat us like adults. And so what, you know, for all intents and purposes, they went from telling us absolutely don't wear a mask, they don't work, to absolutely have to wear a mask because they'll save everyone. And it's funny, though, because people have, for the most part, at least I'd say maybe half the population has complied. And if you were to believe polls, half the population is still terrified. Even in December, we're still basically have the same views that we had in March. And I think maybe half the population is realizing, okay, there's more to this.
Talk about outdoors. I like to play golf. And I remember after going to the Levine Cancer Center here in Charlotte to see my oncologist, the one thing that he was urging me to do is to wear a mask if I play golf.
This makes absolutely no sense. I mean, the reality is that we know certain things about respiratory viruses. And so, for instance, an aerosol that can be suspended in the air, it'll suspend in the air inside. But if you're outside, the air is constantly circulating, besides which, you know, outside is open at the top. There's not a roof over us. And so the air dissipates greatly. And if there's any sunshine, UV radiation kills viruses that are suspended in the air. And so really the safest place you can be is for, you know, most functions is outside. And so this idea that if you're anywhere, you're not going to wear a mask, it's outside. And it never made any sense to me at all. And this really just requires that people not think about the kind of details of the virus. I mean, because honestly, most people that are doing this, they're smart enough to be able to figure this out. It's just that the problem is that when we're in a panic, when we're in fear, we kind of got this fight or flight response, and it just kind of overrides our rational capacity, which requires us to deliberate on these things. And so, you know, I feel sad. I see in my neighborhood, I mean, people will be driving around in their cars by themselves, still wearing masks. And so this is it's a very strange thing, especially more than anything, I worry about the effect that this is going to have on young children who are constantly seeing this, constantly being trained in their muscle memories to think about their fellow human beings, not as neighbors and people to love, creatures made in the image of God, but as sort of vectors for an infectious disease that might kill them. That just can't be good long term.
Talk about the NFL for a moment. I was watching an NFL game this past weekend, and it just seems like it's a case study in cognitive dissonance. You have players on top of one another on the field, no masks, and then you look at the sidelines and you see everybody wearing masks. In fact, if the coaches don't wear masks, they are subject to hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. I mean, that seems to be a picture on your television that just tells you this is crazy.
Yeah, these are hints that maybe a lot of the people that are telling us we have to do this don't even really believe it themselves. It's like Governor Newsom, you know, in California, who told everyone they can't do anything, and then he's hanging out inside with friends without a mask at fancy restaurants. They managed to do both of these things. And it's funny with the NFL, of course, those guys on the field, they are not at risk. These are people at the very peak of their health and conditioning. They're all fairly young. You know, these guys, even if they are COVID positive, are very unlikely to get sick. And the reality is, especially if you're in a stadium outside, that's one of the safer things you can do. I mean, that's the irony, Hank. I mean, the reason that there's a cold and flu season in the Northern Hemisphere is because that's when, you know, it gets cold, and that's when we go inside and we're congregating inside and we sort of spread our air around each other. That's why it happens at a particular time. Now, we had a double spike with COVID-19. Both first it started in New York in the north, and then it hit later in the south. But that was because, unlike the flu, it hit just in January, whereas the flu has already worked its way through the population by the late spring normally because it started in the winter. And so what happened is that COVID-19, or rather the coronavirus, was working its way through the population. In the south in the spring, you know, people are outside. They're in North Carolina. They're playing golf. You get to July and you live in Arizona or Florida, you're spending a heck of a lot more time inside in dry air. And so it was essentially the same kind of conditions, dry inside air and a new virus. And so that's why we think you got the spike in the deep south in the summer, because they were really encountering it for the first time.
So talk about the place for civil disobedience. You know, you go into church, and I've heard this myself. I've been at various churches, pastors, preachers, priests, that telling you that you have to obey the governing authorities. You got to do this. This is the right thing to do. Where's the place where we say, no, I'm not going to do this anymore? Where's that line?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's ultimately, it is a prudential judgment, but I just think of, you know, what Martin Luther King said in his letter from Birmingham jail, quoting Thomas Aquinas, is that an unjust law is no law at all, because the law is ultimately the positive law, is the kind of human written laws that are ultimately supposed to reflect our natures and the natural law that God has created. And so if something is just genuinely unjust, then I think you can ask yourself as a Christian, you could say, okay, when is it appropriate to resist? And sometimes resistance actually causes you personal suffering. I think when we were in a situation, say in March, in which maybe people thought incorrectly, but they could be forgiven for thinking this is really deadly, we need to have a kind of temporary freeze in place process, and it was applied indiscriminately. So in other words, it applied to kind of everyone across the board, then you could at least say, okay, this is being applied in a balanced way. Unfortunately, very quickly, what happened is that churches started getting singled out. So we're suddenly put in the inessential category, or somehow it's much worse to be in church, as you said, than to be in some other group setting.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Jay Richards. For the first time in history, the world shut itself down by choice. The government ordered the closure of tens of thousands of small businesses. Schools across the country sent students home. Churches canceled worship services. Social distancing went from a non-word to a moral obligation overnight. Life will go on, but what is the price of panic? In The Price of Panic, Professors Douglas Axe, William Briggs, and Jay Richards examine the COVID-19 pandemic, because we need to know what happened to keep it from ever happening again. To receive your copy of The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us online at equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
The five books of John are an unparalleled literary masterpiece that provide a majestic tapestry of the whole of redemptive history. Five books of John will help you draw closer to Christ and live the authentic Christian life. This premier production from the Word of Promise features an all-star cast of actors, and Hank Hanegraaff introduces each of John's five books with his memorable Legacy acronym summarizing vital background information, facts regarding location, essence, genre, author, context, and years. Presented in dramatic audio theater, Five Books of John is produced with state-of-the-art audio technology, sound effects, and an original music score. To receive the CRI edition of the Five Books of John audio Bible on CD, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. For the first time in history, the world shut itself down, by choice, fearful of a virus that wasn't well understood. The government ordered the closure of countless businesses, many never to return. Schools sent students home to be taught in front of a computer. Churches canceled worship services. Social distancing went from a non-word to a moral obligation overnight. We need to know what happened to keep it from ever happening again. In The Price of Panic, Professors Jay Richards, William Briggs, and Douglas Axe examine the worst panic-induced disaster in history, the COVID-19 pandemic. To receive your copy of The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org.
Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Professor Jay Richards, in their conversation.
Unfortunately, very quickly, what happened is that churches started getting singled out. So we're suddenly put in the inessential category, or somehow it's much worse to be in church, as you said, than to be in some other group setting. Now, that at that point, that starts to become unjust precisely because it's discriminatory. And so that's why, for instance, John MacArthur's church in California did this. Capital Baptist here in Washington, D.C. did this. They basically went to court and said, the law is not being applied consistently. You're singling out churches, and that's a violation of our First Amendment rights to religion. And truth of the matter is, almost every time this has happened, the judges have ruled in favor of the people complaining and against the government. Because the reality is that governors in states and cities, they have this police emergency power for about 30 days usually. And so if there's a tsunami or something and they need to use it, but that discretion to just be able to lock people down is very short-lived. And in almost every case, we're out many, many months now. And the justification for this, I think, is long since passed. I really do think we're now at the stage where this is just going to keep happening until we decide we're not going to comply. And by not comply, I don't mean violence. I mean just simply refusing to do it, simply refusing to close your business or refusing to close your church, taking all necessary precautions, of course, but just simply refusing to comply. When that happens, I think a lot of these lockdowns and policies, they go away because there's really no way to enforce them unless basically everyone complies with them, which is what's happening right now.
Are the vaccines going to make all of this just be a distant memory?
Well, I would hope so, except that if you look at the news and you look at Dr. Fauci and public health authorities, they're saying the vaccines, even though we're being told it may be a 95% effectiveness, which would be amazing, we're still being told, now this won't be the end of it because we'll still need to maintain social distancing, we'll still need to wear masks, we're not going to ever return to normal, we're going to have to adjust to the so-called new normal. And so that's what's sort of terrifying, because I think a lot of us were comforting ourselves thinking, okay, well, at least when we get a vaccine, that could be a sort of fig leaf that will be a justification to go back to normal. All the public health officials are basically telling us, no, it's not going to happen. And so I don't think we should, you know, even in the best case scenario with the vaccine, that shouldn't comfort us into thinking, okay, let's just hold out, it'll be fine. I think, honestly, if we don't start resisting this in appropriate ways, I think that this could be the new normal and we don't want it.
You just mentioned the word resisting, and it reminds me of what Benjamin Franklin said when he said, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Parse that out for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, essentially, this is a long sort of standing part of the Christian tradition. Of course, we know about Romans 13. We know about the requirement that we're supposed to obey laws, including laws that maybe we don't necessarily like. Maybe you think that a 25-mile-an-hour zone is unjustified. It should be 35 miles an hour. I have that thought pretty much every day in Washington, D.C., but it's not an intrinsically unjust law. And so I think all things being equal, we should comply with those. And even in this spring with many of these rules that I thought this doesn't make any sense, but it's not necessarily unjust initially. But if you are told you're not allowed to go to church, you're not allowed to go to mass, and when you ask for the sort of justification for this, you're told, well, there's a virus out there, and it turns out the infection fatality rate of this virus is comparable to the Hong Kong flu or something like that when we didn't lock anything down. Well, and now at this point, this very justification for essentially curtailing your right to worship, your right to exercise your religion, it's just lacking. There's not a just justification for that. And that's, I think, what we need to, we're going to have to make that kind of calculation. But as long as we believe, for instance, like this COVID tracking poll in July asked Americans what percentage of the population they thought had died of COVID-19. Now, this was just in July, so it had only been going a few months. The average American guessed 9%. So they thought 9% of the population had been killed by COVID-19. Well, the right answer at the time was 0.06%. So the average American thought this virus was 150 times more deadly than it actually is. Now, we got that impression, not from the CDC website, but from the media and from our social media feeds, I assume. And so we've just completely overestimated the dangers. As long as we think that, we might think these laws are just. But when we realize, wait, this is completely out of proportion to anything else that anybody has ever responded to a pandemic in this way, then I think we're going to assess these rules differently.
When I was reading through your book, I pay attention to details, and one of the epigraphs was by Thomas Sowell. He's not just one of my favorite economists, he's just one of my favorite people. And he said in this epigraph, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And that seems to apply to this situation in a particular and peculiar way.
Absolutely, because, I mean, the lockdowns, for instance, that the way that they applied to hospitals. So the assumption was that the hospital system was going to get slammed with COVID-19 patients. That was the justification for the flattening the curve idea that we all saw, that image of the spiky curve without lockdowns and then the smushed flatter curve with lockdowns. The idea is we just do this for a couple of weeks so that we don't overwhelm the healthcare system. But we also use that as a justification, essentially to cancel everything else out that was happening. And as a result of that now, it looks like, according to one study, there'll be about 80,000 missed cancer screenings just in that first 3 months of the lockdown. So in other words, people who their cancer would have been caught if they'd been going in for their test or even just their general, you know, sort of annual physical, got missed. And some percentage of those people will either have a much worse fight with cancer, and then some of them will die as a result of that. That's the real cost. That's why always from the beginning, when you're thinking about public health response, you have to think in terms of trade-offs. Because, I mean, President Trump was right about this right at the beginning. He said, we don't want the cure to be worse than the disease. He had this kind of intuition that shutting everything down is going to have all these spin-off effects, these unintended consequences, and we need to try to anticipate that. And unfortunately, in general, public health officials just seemed almost completely incapable of doing this. Dr. Fauci, who I think, you know, he knows his stuff when he's talking about immunology, he showed himself to be just a classic technocrat when it came to really thinking through the costs and the benefits of a particular policy.
Yeah, I couldn't look at the big picture. Are hospitals really being slammed? I mean, that's what I'm reading in the newspaper even this morning, that hospitals are being slammed. And so we have to take these lockdown precautions seriously, partial lockdown precautions as in North Carolina, because the hospitals are being overwhelmed again. We were told that this was going to happen in New York. You had ships in the harbor that afforded beds. You had all kinds of hospital beds being built by the military, but they went unused. We're
That's
hearing
right.
the same story again. Is it true this time?
It's basically the same story as it was before. And so but the first question, Hank, that people ought to ask is, okay, what normally happens this time of year in hospitals and ICUs? If you actually look at that, you always want to ask yourself, what's the baseline, right? Like how many people in general die at a particular time? This time of year, this is a cold and flu season, and hospitals get their capacity pushed. In fact, Hank, about a year, almost 2 years ago now, I fell down the stairs in our townhouse, and we lived in the townhouse in D.C., ruptured my quad tendon on my left leg, had to be dragged down four flights of stairs in a stretcher, and the first two hospitals turned me away when I was in the ambulance. I finally got to the third one. It was really crowded, just sat on a stretcher for hours before I could get a room, and I asked the nurse, okay, what's happening? And she said, you don't want to get hurt on the first Friday of the month in Washington, D.C. Because like, why? She said, oh, that's when a lot of people cash their checks, they get drunk, and they end up in the emergency room. And so, you see, ER doctors, they all knew that, right? But none of us knew that. Most of us don't think about what's actually happening. So what's happening right now is what tends to happen with a respiratory virus season. We've got it's cold and flu season. Now it's cold and flu and COVID-19 season. So there are an increase in hospitalizations, but it's not really different from what we had before. And as you noted, in New York, we not only had a naval ship that was parked right off the edge of Manhattan, we had the Javits Center with thousands of hospital beds that were not used. We had secondary structures that were built in many hospitals that were not used. And so you want to get the facts on this right. And then the final thing is that people are assuming, okay, let's say the hospitals are being pressured with really strong cases. why do you think the lockdowns work? We still haven't gotten to that question because we're still assuming that lockdowns actually make a difference. But we know, we absolutely know when we look at the data now, that these imposed lockdowns on the general population don't make any discernible difference in the spread of the virus. And so they're not only a waste of time, but they end up basically punishing large numbers of people and not making a difference. But as long as that premise is there, we're going to constantly be asked to be going into lockdowns whenever we get, basically every flu season, we'll be told we've got to lock down the country. That's just crazy.
Is there a correspondence between testing and then the reports in the newspaper of the spikes that are taking place all over the world? Is that because we're doing a whole lot more testing?
Absolutely. Now, I'm not saying there aren't people getting it and that are sick with it, but that's a real case. And so that what happened is that if you had sort of, until essentially May of this year, for all of history, if you talk about cases, what a case was a person that actually was positive. So you test positive, you actually have the bug, and then you're sick enough that your symptoms are so bad that you have to be treated with medicine and maybe even go to the hospital. That's the definition of a case. Well, what happened is that we ramped up our testing. And so in the summer, we got up to 1 million tests every day, large numbers of people being tested a couple of times a week because of their job. They're asymptomatic. They test positive. Well, they are a positive test. They're not a case. But the media, when they're talking about cases, what they mean are reported positive tests. Only a subset are genuine cases.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Jay Richards. Our daily commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you the book, The Price of Panic: How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe, by Douglas X, William Briggs, and Jay Richards. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website at equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The preceding program was pre-recorded. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.